get started again. The next item on the agenda is the status report on activities concerning chromium contamination, the PG&E Hinkley compressor station. Before we get to the staff report on that, I just want to do a quick overview of accomplishments in the last 4 years or so. Just to remind everybody of how far we've come. In 2010, the Water Board requested that we get an independent evaluation of the technologies being considered in the EIR, in the cleanup report, in the feasibility study. So we got independent evaluation from the Department of Toxics. What does SC stand for? Substance Control, thank you, and US EPA to make sure that the range of technologies and the different mixtures of technologies in the feasibility study were cutting edge and appropriate and strong to do the work. Then also in 2011, we had a peer review of the original background study, that we had independent scientists review the original background study. And based on that, now PG&E has agreed to fund a new background study by Dr. Izbecki. In 2010, we had the order for the whole house replacement, whole house water replacement for ion exchange or deeper wells. In 2010, we also had, when the school was still operating, got an agreement from PG&E, or required PG&E, to provide a clean water supply to the school. And the school board came to the meeting and assured us that that school would never close when we agreed to that. We've had facilitation of the community advisory committee meetings provided by the State Water Board and board meetings. We've increased PG&E's level of treatment in the ag units and expanded in-situ remediation. We've continued efforts to investigate the sources of manganese, and just this evening we adopted WDRs to expand the agricultural treatment units. And we have also adopted the EIR which comprehensively evaluates the effects of the long-term cleanups. So we've been making progress over the last 3 or 4 years, and I just wanted to remind everybody of that. And with that, we'll have the staff report.
Good evening, Chair Korn and members of the board. My name is Lori Kemper. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer, and I'm going to give the Water Board's status report tonight. Lisa Dernbach, who's our project lead on this project, is on vacation, well-deserved, and of course she can't rest.
I'm not sure everyone can hear
you. Can everybody hear me? Okay,
I can be closer to the microphone.
Is that good?
Yeah. So Lisa is on vacation. She's also, as part of her vacation, volunteering for a group called Water for Life in Guatemala, helping install drinking water wells. Just can't rest. So I'm going to be giving the update.
Oh, and board members, you have the PowerPoint again in the back.
PowerPoint is in the agenda packet, and it was posted on the website. And also, later I'll be referring to a letter that we received from Carmela Vasilevich. But tonight I really am just going to go through this fairly quickly. We've been quite busy, and so has PG&E. We had PG&E under a number of requests and requirements to produce reports over the December-January period, and then staff was busy responding to all those reports in February and March. So I'm going to be talking about the chromium plume delineation status, a request by PG&E to reduce sampling frequency at some of their monitoring wells. I'm going to be talking about the action plan for the western, what we refer to as the western finger, and the results of PG&E's manganese investigation, at least to date, and the next steps, the interim water program, and basically that's it. Talk a little bit about whole house water. So PG&E has been under an order since 2008 to comprehensively delineate the plume, and current facts are up there on the board. And I think most folks are aware of the fact that for the plume is mostly delineated. So this this picture here shows the area we call the lower plume or the core plume area, the compressor stations down here. And this area has now been delineated. We've kind of concluded that PG&E has no longer has requirements to investigate these boundaries. We know the groundwater flows primarily northward in this area. This is the Thompson Road area where PG&E has continued to show that they have sufficient hydraulic plume capture, so they're pulling water, the shallow water, back southward here. And there is this kind of separation where we see areas now that are less than 3.1 parts per billion chromium, hexane chromium. In this area, we still have some question marks, and we also have chromium above 3.1 in areas, you know, that are up here in the north. So we've asked PG&E to continue investigating these areas. You know, it looks like they don't. It looks like there's a lot of question marks and a lot of dashed lines, meaning we don't know exactly where the 3.1 line is. But in most situations, we have a number of monitoring wells throughout this area that show concentrations above 3.1, and then say we might have a well out here that's non-detect. What we don't know is where the approximate 3.1 line is, because the distance between the monitoring wells is too great to kind of estimate or extrapolate. So we've asked PG&E to install several additional monitoring wells. PG&E had requested that they not have to install monitoring wells pursuant to the cleanup order that required short distances, 2,600 feet between monitoring wells, and asked if they could rely on a combination of new monitoring wells and domestic wells in, again, in this north area here. The current whole house replacement water program that PG&E has been providing, the ion exchange systems or bottled water or property buyout, ends about here. And there are a number of homes up in this area where we really have no information. So PG&E has offered, in lieu of installing a number of monitoring wells in this area, to offer these folks reverse osmosis systems, which remove about 85% of the chromium in their well. And as this would be an interim solution until a new drinking water standard is established, that we think is going to happen this year. And they would also, as part of that program, measure the raw water quality out of the well, so we would know how much chromium is in this area, which right now we don't have a lot of information. So we accepted that plan, and then there is some new monitoring wells that will be installed in six locations, kind of about where these red question marks are. One of the most important areas is in what we call the Hinkley Gap, which is between two areas of bedrock, and we know all the water from the Hinkley Valley flows through that area, and that's just a good spot for us to gauge the magnitude of the chromium concentrations in that area. So PG&E submitted a work plan in January to install those six wells and to sample all the active domestic wells in that northern area, which we refer to here as the eastern area of the Harper Dry Lake Valley, but it is really that north. It's very far north of the Hinkley School. And then they would also analyze about 15 to 20 domestic wells. And as I mentioned, the reverse osmosis. We conditionally accepted this plan. The big condition we added was that if they can't get access or permission to sample these domestic wells, then they will be required to install monitoring wells in those locations if they can get access, say, on a road right away or something like that, just so we can get the information. So we accepted that plan, and they're moving forward on that. And then PG&E also requested to reduce sampling frequency of a number of wells from quarterly to annually. And we identified that of the 51 wells, they had requested that reduction, that only eight really were in a low-risk location that we might accept. But we essentially declined their request to make any changes at this juncture, and it is something that the Water Board is going to continue to evaluate as part of a new development of a new cleanup order to really comprehensively assess all the monitoring wells that PG&E currently samples and to determine which ones on a more holistic basis can be the frequency, sampling frequency can be reduced because maybe they've shown the same quality of water for several quarters. So we have let PG&E know that we're going to continue to evaluate that, and we're willing to meet with them to look at. We have some other wells that we think are maybe lower risk than some of the wells that PG&E identified, so we're willing to kind of relook at this request in the next several months. And then on the what we were calling the Western Finger, this is the area of the plume where the freshwater injection system is. This is Sarah Road and Mountain View Road over here, and Hinckley Road is here. The Hinckley School is about 1,300 feet off of this map, and this is the railroad, Santa Fe Avenue. This is an area where we saw increasing chromium west of the freshwater injection system, which was supposed to contain the chromium on this side of the plume. And the most recent quarterly monitoring report actually showed a monitoring well in this area increasing to 7.2 parts per billion. There was, however, a monitoring well up in this area that was above 3.1 parts per billion in past sampling, and it's now gone below 3.1. So we're not exactly sure what's going on here, but PG&E did a number of investigations. They did some pumping tests on this agricultural well, which is part of the old Heifer Ranch, and they had proposed doing some extraction from this well to try to bring down the concentrations of chromium in this area. So we approved their work plan to do this pumping, and in the short term, if the water coming out of this well is less than 3.1, which it may be because you kind of average these concentrations of 7 and 3 and it's a little deeper than these shallow monitoring wells, then that water can be applied on the ranch for dust control. If it's above 3.1, they're required to treat it before they use it for dust control or irrigation, and they can only use the water on their land. And if that does not solve the problem over the next 6 months, then PG&E has committed to look at piping water back over to this area where they're planning their expansion for the ranch land treatment unit. So that's essentially what all of this says. And you'll see that we're allowing the water truck, and here's sort of a one version of a water truck, because we know there's an animal in the group. And then we also had PG&E investigate the creation of manganese as part of their in-situ remediation where they inject ethanol. We knew, and the permit allows them to basically produce manganese, which they're not really producing it, but it becomes mobile in the groundwater as part of their treatment system for a period of time. Their report that they submitted to us in November provided enough evidence for us to accept their conclusions, which is that the manganese plume is contained within the land that they own and then within the area that's defined as the project area for in-situ remediation. They did begin some tracer tests to better understand how water moves and whether water could move outside their project area. It will take several more months to look at, they're testing wells, further away as the water moves through the aquifer. They proposed remediating a number of injection wells that were clogged, primarily through biofouling. The ethanol injections do create this biological film, so they're planning to replace those, and this was the same place where they requested reduced sampling frequency. We concurred with their report. We did request that they look at adding some injection wells, not just replace the current ones, but actually expand the use of the IRZ system and technology, because it does appear to be quite effective at reducing the exhaling and chromium concentrations in the groundwater. And as part of this letter of acceptance, we requested that PG&E provide updated model results. This is the model that they used in the feasibility study, where they predicted that they could get all the water below 50 parts per billion within a six-year period. That was 3 years ago. And we want them to kind of reevaluate if that's a legitimate time period. So it's an opportunity for them to look at additional data they now have from the effectiveness of their treatment, and also to basically plug in more realistic information about their agricultural treatment units and their current plans to expand their agricultural treatment units, so they would evaluate, how quickly they're going to see chromium be reduced from from above 50 parts per billion to below 50 parts per billion, as well as how long it would take them to get to 10 parts per billion. And those are two, what we think are realistic and legitimate time periods that we could be looking at in the next cleanup order, where we would be requiring PG&E to have some interim dates for interim cleanup. And then, as you know, the background study will be conducted over the next 3 to 5 years, and at that point we could be talking about what's, you know, final cleanup numbers and the length of time to get there. And then PG&E had requested, actually last year, that they had said that it was a little too burdensome for them to meet the requirements of the replacement water order as it pertained to providing bottled water. That we required the water to meet less than 0.06, which is the detection limit for chromium at commercial labs. And they could not get a commitment from bottled water companies to meet that standard. And so they, under our order, they were required to measure that water quality before they provided bottled water to make sure it was meeting water quality below 0.06 parts per million. So they requested that that limit be changed, and we agreed last year to allow them to serve bottled water to the people of Hinckley as long as it was below 1.2 parts per billion, which is the average background concentration as currently defined in the Hinckley Valley. So that decision was made last year in May, and we just recently made that official. We had sent a letter out, but then Patty just recently signed an amendment to the cleanup order just to make sure that it's attached to that order. It was because the decision had been made in a letter format, and so really it was just kind of cleaning up the order language. That was just recently signed. And then this is just an update of where we're at with the Whole House Water Program. So of the 368 eligible residences in the expanded Whole House Water Replacement Program, there are now 32 individuals with operating systems. Three residents had systems, and they have now been purchased. They've sold their property to Caltrans as part of the new Highway 58 alignment, so those have been removed. And then 263 individuals chose property acquisition. Of those 263, 82 are still in negotiation. So that's the set of people that could potentially end up back in a situation where they want whole house, like they want to stay if they don't negotiate a final buyout. But I think that may change because the next slide is that we have heard that the Department of Public Health is going to make a decision on a drinking water standard sometime between April and June, but we've heard it's going to be closer to April 15th. And at that point in time, we're going to be talking about the transition and whether or not PG&E will continue maintaining those ion exchange systems and reverse osmosis systems. So at this point in time, PG&E has not made a decision about how that will go, and they have issued individual letters to the residences to let them know what the costs of maintaining the systems are, and they are encouraging individuals to meet with PG&E to go over kind of a detailed cost sheet of what the different various costs are to maintain and operate their current systems. And then in terms of the next water board actions, at this point, we're working on finalizing a contract with USGS to begin the background study. This month, at the beginning of the month, we had to take a resolution to the state board to have them authorize staff and the water board to essentially manage this contract, which is close to $5 million. And the board did pass that resolution authorizing staff to do that and to receive the funds from PG&E and to prepare contracts with USGS. We did receive the funds. The money was sent in this month, so the State Board now has that money. And Ann Holden and the folks at the State Board are working on getting that contract in place. Unfortunately, the contracting process between the State Board, the Department of General Services, and USGS is not a simple or easy thing, and we don't anticipate that contract will actually be in place for several months. That's just the nature of what other contracts are on their list. So, but we continue to participate in the technical working groups. meeting with doctors Becky and PG&E and the IRP manager and members of the community advisory committee to work through just the logistics of implementing this study. And then the next big thing that we plan on working on is actually a new cleanup and abatement order. Again, PG&E has promised they'd get this information on cleanup times to us in July. We hope to share that information with the public and for us to evaluate it and the IRP manager to ask questions and the community to ask questions and begin to start developing new requirements for PG&E for the long-term cleanup. And we would hope to bring that, at least some conceptual elements, back to the board in September with adoption maybe in November or early in 2015. And on the top of the list here is the possibility of the need for either for revised waste discharge requirements. We currently have a permit with PG&E requiring the related to all the in-situ work currently. There's a general permit. So there is allowance within that general permit for them to expand their in-situ remediation system up to a point. So we're evaluating whether or not PG&E has plans that would go beyond what the board's already authorized. There's several things. The things Lisa's already approved and recommended we think are within the current authorization and the current general permit, but we're taking a look at that, and that'll be part of conversations with PG&E about their needs and our needs to try to see increased treatment in those areas. So we'll be looking at whether we need to bring that permit back to the board to authorize additional work. But that's all just a needed thing. And that's all I have. Any questions?
Start with Mr. Dias this time.
Yes, one question, please. Lori, could you please go back to slide 9? Yeah, that's it. You'd indicated that PG&E had requested or proposed to replace some injection wells. Isn't there a less expensive solution? In other words, couldn't the clogging be rehabilitated or cleaned in some way?
They've tried that. Yeah, the current permit does allow them to use a number of techniques and like hydroperoxide and different descalers, you know, and they scrub the well screen, and they've done a number of those types of activities, and there are just some wells that they just want to replace. I mean, they routinely do rehab, and when they see the efficiency going down in terms of accepting water, so they've been doing that over the years, but there's just several wells that they've decided it would be better to replace. And then I think Lisa looked at the distance between the injection wells and thought there was areas where they could install additional wells or potentially expand on the edges and that sort of thing. So those are some of the recommendations we're looking at.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Mr.
Debbie? No questions.
Ms. Cox?
No questions, and I want to thank the chair for that overview of where we've been and where we are. I'm new to the board since last July, and this has been going on for many, many years, and it's really amazing when you hear the amount that has been accomplished over the last year or so.
Mr. Pumphrey.
Just one question. On slide 5, you refer to the possibility that reverse osmosis systems could be installed in some of the residences. I'm wondering, would those be subject to removal depending on the findings of future data gathering and or mapping?
Yes. Although I think part of PG&E's offer, and they may want to talk about it, but PG&E's offer of installing them was the notion that they would take a lot less. That when they have gone in for the 32 residences and installed systems, they've kind of let them know that they'll give the property owner the option to keep everything in place after they're no longer, if they make the decision to no longer maintain them, so that the homeowner can maintain it themselves, or they are willing to go back and take everything out and put it back the way they found it. So that's kind of what they've told people and had people sign agreements on. In this situation, this sort of, it was like what I'm calling an in-lieu plan, was the notion that there would be less overall expense, not only for PG&E, but for the homeowner, that if they installed the reverse osmosis system, that would be something that PG&E could just give them. They just would no longer be maybe subject to testing and maintaining of them, but they're much less expensive to maintain, and many people use them in this area, so it would be something that's just more predictable and easy to continue to run. And again, it removes about 85% of the hexagon and chromium, so if you had, you know, three parts, you know, five parts per billion, and it was going to knock it down to less than two, that would be that would be seen as something that, you know, people might find acceptable. And I did want to add a couple things I forgot, kind of these late additions, if I can do that.
Sure.
Okay. So we did receive a letter on Monday from Carmela Spesicevic, and she really was wanted to raise two concerns, and she's concerned that the couple of recent water board decisions related to plume delineation, you know, she's not happy with it. She really would like to continue to put the burden of proof on PG&E and really establish where the plume is consistent with the current orders of not relying on domestic wells, but actually installing monitoring wells on the same frequency and distance that we've had in other places. And the other concern is on the replacement water quality as well, that she wants us to hold PG&E to the same level that we had in the original order, the less than 0.06, because some folks, obviously if you average 1.2 parts per billion, some folks' water were much better than 1.2 parts per billion, and she believes that they should continue to receive water that is non-detect as opposed to that could have traces of chromium. So those are her concerns, and she's is distressed that it feels that we're just relaxing all our rules and that she doesn't want that to continue. So those are her main concerns. And I believe Darren Banks is going to maybe address a little more of those issues, but those were primarily her two concerns, and that letter is in the record for this meeting. And then last thing I wanted to share with you, because this had, last time we were here in January, there were some questions about the water board's presence in the Hinkley Valley and who does what and what are people's responsibilities. And we've created a contact sheet that's called the Lahontan Water Board Hinkley Area Roles and Responsibilities, and it lists the tasks that the water board has sort of taken on in this area, and it identifies who the staff person is who's been assigned to that activity, their phone number and email address. So we have things split out here in terms of the chromium cleanup, which is Lisa Dornbach's the primary contact, Ann Holden's the primary contact for specifically the agricultural treatment units, the permit she just worked on. And she's also our point person on the background study. As it relates to agricultural in general and nitrate investigations and dairies, that's handled out of the Victorville office, and Mike Plidek and Jay Cass and Gethsemane are our main contacts. As it relates to the current operation of the compressor station, Brianna Bergen from our Victorville office is the primary contact. As it relates to nursery products composting facility, that's Brianna. And as it relates to landfills and other site cleanup activities in the area, that's Patrice Copeland's responsibility and her geologist in the Victorville office. So those names are all listed here. And as it relates to barstool perchlorate, that's Cindy Mittens and her staff. So hopefully this is available in the back of the room, and this hopefully will help all the people at Hinkley know who to contact if they have questions or concerns about different water quality issues and projects in this area.
Could we get copies of that for all the board members too?
It's in your
room. It's in
my room.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you for putting that together. That's helpful. Is this working? I don't know.
You have to have all of them off except for the one person talking. That's why some of them don't work.
I've just turned
mine somebody else has theirs still on.
Mine's off now.
Thanks. Okay. Okay, with that, has everyone's had, all the board members have had a chance to ask their questions. So that's right. Okay, so now we'll go to public comment and questions.
Okay. I have three cards on this issue. I'll start with Barbara Ray from CAC.
Good evening, Chair and Board members. Thank you for allowing me to make some remarks tonight. My name is Barbara Ray, and I'm a longtime Hinckley resident of Hinckley. I'd like to make some comments about the whole house treatment systems that PG&E has recently provided to some of us in the Hinckley community. I am one of the residents who elected to have this system installed with expectations that it would provide me with whole house water for many years to come. As you know, it is unwise to drink or shower with the Hinckley's untreated private well water. When the systems were being initially discussed, I do recall the conditions which were also mentioned. That is, that I could have the system at PG&E's expense for up to 5 years or until the Chromium 6 MCL was determined. Well, it looks like with the MCL on the near horizon, PG&E is wasting no time in telling us about our options and their willingness to keep maintaining these systems. Just when I started to feel more confident drinking the water coming into my home, the program starts to move toward a full shutdown. What I mean is that those of us with the systems received a letter from PG&E just this last month basically saying that the program was at a near end. But if we wanted to keep the treatment system, PG&E would give it to us and we'd be responsible for the maintenance, which is not cheap. For some, I can assure you it would be at more than $10,000 a year. While I do understand that the programs do come to an end, the speed with which PG&E wants to step back from its drinking water delivery commitment is just way, way too fast. As a Hinckley resident who has been affected by the Chromium 6 plume, possibly physically, but most definitely financially with the decline in our property values, and most certainly emotionally, and one who has lived through all of this, I'd like to see any transition which is being concerned handled, please, with great care. Part of that care is for me understanding the future of the groundwater conditions at my well. As I understand it, PG&E has the ability to predict what may happen at my well based on groundwater flow, and I'd like to know more. PG&E's letter says that they will assess the existing program using all available information. PG&E is real big in plans, so I'd like for their plan to be openly discussed. It also dawns on me that the high cost PG&E put in their letter are run the system to achieve no Chromium 6 in my water. But if the MCL is going to be at 10 parts per billion, I think I need to be provided with what these costs would be too. Maybe they're going to be less. I would also like to know the costs associated with the removal of PG&E's chromium in my domestic well. PG&E should be responsible for their chromium in my domestic well, and I should not have to pay to clean up any part of this contamination. So if PG&E does stop the whole house water replacement program, I request that you reinstate the whole house water replacement to include Section 3A. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Next, I have Darren Banks. Do you have anything to say about that? Just a second, Darren.
Do you have any response to this?
Well, I guess, Amy's asking, our chair is asking if I have any response to that. I would just, again, explain what our limitations are in terms of providing whole house replacement water. Even though we can require PG&E to clean up to background, so whatever is background, PG&E has to clean up all the way to that. Even though we have that ability, we don't have the ability for them to provide whole house replacement water if the water is not below the MCL. So if a person's well has something like 5 and the MCL is 10, we're limited in what we're able to require PG&E. PG&E is able, though, to...
Go ahead.
So essentially, that's sort of the limits on our legal abilities to require full house replacement water. Was that what you were
before? I'm sorry, I've just been reminded that we have two other PowerPoint presentations, which I forgot about. So we should probably proceed with those before we... And we'll go back to public comment. Darren, you'll get your chance shortly. New chair, training wheels.
Didn't
Good evening, Kevin Sullivan with PG&E. I have a very brief update. I'd like to just take a second to touch on a few questions that were raised that maybe I could add some clarity or at least some perspective on. Mr. Dias, regarding the cleaning of the IRZ wells, we clean them fairly regularly, but actually in one of our status reports, we had requested the ability to put new wells in because at some point you've gotten all the benefit that you can get out of a given location, and it's better to move that over. There was some, ambiguous language in the permit. We wanted to clarify that we were, in fact, allowed to do that, and I believe the board staff has concurred, so we're working on designs to do exactly that within the footprint of the old permit. Mr. Pumphrey, regarding the RO, our intent was that, we understand that there's still questions about the northern part of the plume. That's why we've hired the USGS. They need time to get their work done. We identified about 15 more houses up to the north of the plume, and we said while this multi-year process was going on, what could we do to give folks some comfort there? I want to remind everybody that of all the samples we've taken, none of the homes are above the new proposed MCL. They're all below 10. But we have found other constituents that are common in desert environments like arsenic, TDS, and that sort of stuff. And the RO is effective on that broad sweep. And our offer was to install these ROs and basically give them to the folks. We think it's an appropriate technology. We think it's a good fit for a variety of common desert water questions. So while we're sorting out whose chrome is whose and where the plume is, we thought that this was a good step. A few items, just to update. I want to just reiterate a couple of things. We've really been trying. We're trying to do our part. You heard from Ms. Kemper. We finished the manganese investigation. A year and a half ago, the question was, where's your manganese? You asked us to go out and do that investigation. We spent several million dollars on that. We found out that our manganese is right in the center of the plume. We know where it is. We've got good tracking. I'll suggest that the board staff did a good job in the initial network that was set up. We've reproven that now, and so hopefully we've got that behind us. And we look forward to future expansions of the IRZs. The background study, while the state board was voting, we were paying. There's been a $4.5 million check already cut. It's been deposited with the state, so that's in an escrow account. So that's been put to bed. We understand that there were concerns about if PG&E was going to pay for it or not. That check's it's not in the mail. It's been delivered. We're looking forward to the modeling as well. We had always intended, in fact, the feasibility study that this all of the EIR and all the paper that we've been pushing for the last few years, the 2010 feasibility study, which was the last modeling that we did, we put a marker down then. We said this is based on what we know now. Before we go to final remedy design, we'll redo the modeling, and we're working on that right now, and we'll be delivering that to the board staff by July 1st, and we think that's going to really crystallize what we can accomplish here in the next few years. So the other items I wanted to share just very briefly were, and you have a figure for this, Ms. Cox, you were asking about what was likely to occur now that the ag permit has been approved. We've been working on design plans anticipating an approval tonight. Our hope is to have this formal report of waste discharge done during April. And our current plan is shown here. The light green are the currently existing ag units. The DVD is cross-hatched there. But we've done a lot of work in terms of well sizing, pipeline orientation, biological clearance. And our current plan is that we're going to try to expand the ranch unit here. We think if everything falls together with the biological sign-offs from the wildlife agencies, that we can get this done this summer. That will add several dozen acres up there. There is this gray area which has been deemed as potential habitat, and while we ultimately might be able to clear that, that'll be a multi-year process. And we said let's take what we can get now and build that out, so we'll have an expansion there. The second item is the one that, from a technical perspective, I'm most interested in. We've renamed it the Community East. That's Community Boulevard, the eastern side. We hope to be able to start that in the fall. That'll be a brand new pivot on the former location of the former East LTU. This will help to eliminate some of those plume bulge questions that you've been hearing us allude to, and also treat the core. There is an area down here, another gray area, that has been identified as habitat, so we had to kind of move our design around from that. And we're planning to put another large pivot in here. This we dubbed that the Fairview AU. That'll probably come online next spring, during the spring planting season. And then the other piece that we need to do, I know some of you in the past have been out and seen the Desert View Dairy. This has been the old workhorse of the containment system. It's been running since 2004. This is the one that looks like corduroy. The fields haven't been plowed in 10 years. And so we're working on design alternatives to convert that to a drag drip system. It'll be more efficient. It'll be a better use. It'll let the farmer actually grow some better crops there. So those are the four things that we're working in design right now. We're still working on exact acreages, but due to the success of these square pivots, our initial plan had figured a round pivot in that square hole, but with the square pivots, we think we're actually going to be able to pick up some acreage in that. But we're still working through those final details. And again, we hope to have that submitted, that report of waste discharge submitted in the next 30 to 45 days. And then just one other item to share with you. Last month, February, we did a site visit with Mojave Water Agency to show them. They were curious about water use and, you know, and the like. They seem very interested in the drag drip technology. We've had several discussions with other farmers in the area. In some ways, with the drought upon us, the efficiency of water use to get a given acre of alfalfa planted or whatnot is becoming more and more interesting, and we think this is going to become sort of a showcase, frankly, because it taking out that spray step drops 10 to 15% on the water use. So we're working on that. We're looking forward to trying to cooperate with some other farmers. We may be back to you in the future with sort of farm swap ideas as we move forward on this. Those are, like I said, in the discussion stages. So that's all I had. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for Mr. Sullivan? Thank you very much. Okay, our last PowerPoint. Dr. Webster.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Dean Webster. I'm the IRP manager. My goal is to provide technical advice to the community and answer any questions they may have during the conduct of the work. As I understand it, through Water Board staff last time, the board requested that I say a few remarks about my perceptions about how the community educational process and update outreach is going. So my remarks tonight will not be focused on any of the technical issues that you've heard tonight, probably over and over again.
You might want to project a little more. It's hard to hear you.
Sorry.
Good. So I want to focus on the technical remarks, or technical issues tonight. I'll focus more on the mechanisms of communication and where, I guess, in the third year of technical outreach, where I think the program should go with respect to technical education. Got a few slides that I'll go through as follows. So in general, despite the decline in the Hinckley population, there still is a large attendance at the community meetings. Roughly 60 to maybe 85 people attend once a month. The CAC meets once a week, essentially, and we hope to kind of tailor that to the ultimate objectives of the job as we move ahead. But the monthly meetings are a place where people come and learn in an informal atmosphere. And I'll talk a little bit towards the end of my talk about how I think that can be restructured for more effective communication. We've also, in last year, attracted people to a barbecue. In fact, there was more than 200 people showed up at the barbecue in midsummer and again learned about various aspects of the job. When we hold these meetings, we populate the environment with posters and also, as you can see over here, the use of various visual aids and models that I think have got a future role in describing technical activities of the job. We'll do our best to get the size of the tires correct and the drag grip system appropriately sized in future models. This picture here indicates again some of the variety we're trying to bring to the meetings. In this particular session, probably a couple of months ago, I identified there was perhaps about 12 major building blocks to the success of the ultimate PG&E remediation. And we slowly built these building blocks with large boxes at the end of the room. It definitely kept people's attention focused. Any tools we can use to try and gain attention are worthwhile. And also in the center of that one is our model of the blue, again with small features identified on it. This slide will come at you rather quickly. I've probably given about 23, 24 presentations to the Hinckley community. I've generated hundreds and hundreds of slides with varying degrees of technical complexity. But in general, I think most aspects of the project have been discussed with the community over and over again. So for example, such issues as the SET program, I'll just actually bring all these slides in. You can refer to them in your handout. But these are examples of pictorial timelines, plume maps, the EIR, etc. that have been used over and over again. Suffice to say, there's no lack of content available for the community to refer to. It is also posted on a reasonably clear website called HinckleyGroundwater.com that we publicize for the community. One of the things that I think the community did not see coming, or I didn't see coming, was the large number of folks who elected to have their homes purchased through the property purchase program that was offered in parallel with the Whole House Water Program. As you hear tonight, roughly about 250 people have elected, or 250 residences, that's more people, but 250 residences have elected to buy into or go through that program. Versus about 30 accepting the Whole House Water System. That definitely, as you can imagine, has removed people from the community. It has cut into the attendance at meetings. But again, I think as some of you have noted in previous meetings, this community has got a tremendous tenacity for trying to understand the facets of this project. So, trying to do a kind of adjustment to try and match the role of the independent program manager to the needs of the job. This diagram attempts to show that there's probably a cone of shrinking ideas that need to be discussed and talked about as the job moves ahead. We move from the left-hand side of the scores and hundreds of slides that have been used over to probably about six major issues as listed here, all of which have been highlighted again tonight at various points in the discussion. So this year, I'm going to focus probably on these major 6 points for outreach, such as plume definition, ag units, as Mr. Sullivan just talked about, the background study that was referred to tonight, and the Northwest Freshwater Injection System that's still got some question marks associated with how it's actually functioning and operating. So, in grand summary, here is kind of a mid-course correction that I'm basically kind of providing to you tonight in terms of the role of the IRP manager.
that was whose function was derived or created a number of years ago, I think, to pair the whole house water order. So on the left-hand side, you can see that the main goals of the IRP manager were outreach and teaching. The style that I've had to work with is to try and separate the technical issues from the political issues of the job. That's not been an easy task, I can assure you. The techniques that I've used have mainly been presentations, but in a more of a lecture-style format in the community meetings. I think I'm going to change that and go to more of a kind of focus group session where the meeting is less structured and less and more informal. I'll say more in a few seconds about that. Also this year, we used two groups of expertise to assist my activities, namely on the EIR, and we also brought in a toxicology risk assessment to talk about the health effects of Chrome 6. But tweaking, as I say, a mid-course correction for 2014, I'm going to kind of reassert or continue to reassert that my opinions of this job are my independent or professional opinions. And you know, as you can imagine, I am talked to a lot of people and advised to say various things about various parts of the project, but my independence remained true, especially into 2014. In terms of meetings, many more one-on-ones. We've had, as I've described to my own staff, I think we need to get more back to a bedside manner with more individual community members, especially in the past couple of months. We've been out to actual individual residences and talked to them about problems they've had with their individual water wells, etc. So, been encouraged by that. I think less of the large community meeting focus, but more of an outreach towards individuals, especially in the areas in the far north of the Plume. Techniques for communicating, as I said before, I think the use of models, the use of compelling visuals, photographs, illustrating ideas are far more powerful than single bullet. And so some of the photographs I showed here show a model in the center of the table. And in fact, over to the far right here is a new model that we developed in the Plume that we unearthed at the last community meeting. And it was surrounded by many people trying to understand what it was actually saying. But it gives the chance to interact rather than talk from slides. And then, potentially as appropriate, the use of external experts again, or even a guest speaker. I think maybe like coaching a soccer team, you can only get them so far in terms of pushing folks. So I think that bringing in occasionally an external speaker in just to talk about such things as ag treatment or even groundwater flow would probably revitalize attention on some of these important issues. So my talk tonight was not on technical issues. It was mainly giving an update on, I think, where the communication techniques have been and where I hope to kind of move into 2014. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your attention.
Does the board have any questions for Dr. Webster? Mr. Pumphrey?
Not at this point.
Ms. Scott?
No.
Mr. Guy? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will resume now with public comments and questions. I apologize for the interruption.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Board. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the Plume delineation, the recent change that we had, discounting or cutting line off on Dixie East and in the West. And specifically right now, directing to the Plume to the east. It was, as I understood, a little bit of history. During meetings and in total working group meetings, which includes PG&E, the USGS, the IRP managers, Hinckley residents, and board staff are all part of the total working group that helped develop the study. During this time, it's been a huge, long process, and you know, working out the study and doing this. And it was clear that Mr. Sullivan and PG&E, you know, what their intent, that they wanted to shut down the west and they wanted to shut down to the east. They wanted the ability to be able to contain the Plume in those areas. And we came to an agreement, or at least I felt that we had. It's okay. Thank you. The words that are used were, we came to an agreement that actionable items, okay? We all agreed from that point that actionable items, which means items that would distinguish, you know, background in plume issues, would come directly from the flow of the study, whether it was PG&E, Stantec, whoever, through the TWG, and then actionable items would be ultimately through Dr. Isbick. Okay, it took PG&E and the Water Board 3 weeks to fault on that verbal agreement that we all had. We talk about wanting to have everything out in the open and have it clear, and we're all in agreement. We're all in these rooms. We're working really hard. And it's all kumbaya and everything's great, but it took 3 weeks for them to have their meeting in Tahoe, and then Patty, I don't want to say your last name, I always butcher your last name, so sorry. To come up with the letter saying, using the hydrology maps, the flow maps, saying, okay, the plume's not going to go this way, or it's not going to be in the west because of the fault line, and because it's upgrading and all the other reasons. Well, historically, there's a lot of the scientific evidence or proof that could have been used to make a determination on that, and whether it's historical, whether it's pumping, natural events, whether it's PG&E pushing and pulling our plume around for the last 10 years, it's feasible that their chromium 6 could be spread anywhere and coming north. I'm going to concede at this point until we have proof that yes, downgrading or on the other side of the fault line. I understand that. That makes sense. Okay. But it's conceivable the other way. So that letter coming out shortly after the total working group agreed upon no actionable items at a short period of time after the agreement was discouraging to me, and it was very inappropriate. The water board staff has said for years that 3.1, that's the background in Hinkley. Okay, that's our board will not move from that background until we get another proper study done. They've told us many, many times. Even though we go to them and say, look, we have data to show this had there was none here, non-detect here. Now they're showing this is PG&E's 3.1, and that's what we've had to live with. And personally, that's how part of the way our community has been able to be dismantled in the way that it has in the last 3 years. Okay, so going by the Water Board's rules and playing by the rules, we worked. The Water Board has done a great job of requiring PG&E to put in the monitoring two wells with loopholes and holes, of course, not making sure that they're within the 2,600 allowable feet to connect the dots, because there's areas, you know, specifically in the north and in the east where they don't connect the dots. You know, PG&E's not wanting to put in as many monitoring wells and use in connection with domestic wells. Well, we lose domestic wells because either they're bought and they're destroyed, or there's large portions now of just desert. So because we have no information or data in those points, there's no data, so PG&E gets to draw the line wherever they want. And the way that whole last part transpired was for sure contrary to what the Water Board and the staff has been telling the community for the last 3 years. And it was for sure against our verbal agreement in the total working group that says no actionable items will be done except for through Dr. Isbick. So I would like for Patty and the staff to relook at that letter and consider going back to what the original plume definition order was. And then Miss, I'm not going to say Carmela's last name because I think Lori, I would butcher it way worse than Lori. So, Carmela and I spoke a couple weeks ago, and her letter, it closely resembles, you know, how I feel. at this point. I mean, and hopefully you guys get the time to at least go over it. So, specifically, the parts where she discusses about the gaps in the wells. The last thing that I'm going to speak about is the whole house replacement and the letter that has been sent out. I mean, PG sent the letter out saying the MCL passes, basically we'll come in for free, we'll take the system out, or we'll turn it over to you. And I know that you said that you have no ability to enforce the MCL, and I've been advised in what I've read, I don't believe that to be true. We have, specifically in the letter, as it states, as required by Section 13304, parentheses F, of the California Water Code, and stated in binding number 4 in the attached order, the replacement water must be comparable quality to that which residents had prior to the discharge of waste that was adversely affecting the water supply. Okay, so, and there's other, I guess it's the way, just like a lot of California laws, it's the way you read it. And there's sections that say you may give them replacement water. So I believe that you have the ability and the legal right to. Our water has been damaged, especially specifically in me. I can show non-detect in my well, and gradually over the years. The numbers aren't high. I understand that. Okay, but when you have the entity, the Department of Health, as it's been called, your sister partner in the government, established the public health role. And so you can. So the 2011 CAO should be taken into account when determining the fate of the whole house placement program. The background study will help us to understand where PG&E's historical discharge has migrated, and will help us understand the difference between PG&E's Chromium 6 and natural Chromium 6 background. The fate of the whole house replacement program should be coupled with the background study, since a lot of the questions will be answered at the department. At the completion of the background study. Even though the MCL is expected to be issued by the California Department of Health in a few months, the MCL will not tell us the difference between PG&E's chromium and background. But the background study will. What is most important to remember is that the purpose of this board is to ensure public health and to oversee the cleanup of the contamination. The MCL is based on feasibility, health risks, and costs. In this case, feasibility is not an issue. Mr. Sullivan has said publicly that PG&E can clean the chromium 6 to non-detect in front of board staff. At this time, there is no proof that any natural chromium 6 exists. We know only one source that PG&E discharges into our water. It is reasonable to request the water board invoke the original whole house placement order to include Section 3A. This will give PG&E the opportunity to prove to the board and the community that they are not responsible for what they claim is not theirs. I request that the board maintain that you guys give us the original whole house water replacement order if PG&E decides to go ahead and step away from what they're calling the voluntary program. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Niemeyer, can you explain the difference between our authority regarding cleanup of the groundwater and providing drinking water quality?
Sure. So we, as I stated previously, we have the ability to require cleanup all the way to background. The provision that allows us to require replacement water comes out of that section that, it's section 13304, and it does require that the water that's being replaced be of comparable quality. There's really not a definition of what's comparable. There was an order that came out from the state board that interpreted this section and essentially said that a water is not affected, a domestic water supply is not affected unless it is not meeting the MCLs. So that limited the water board's ability to require replacement water to those situations where the water, the domestic supply, isn't meeting the MCLs. We set out in our original replacement order all of our legal justification, and we relied on the public health goal at that time because there wasn't a MCL for hexavalent chromium, and based on that, required the replacement water. Once there is an MCL, and our order recognizes this, our original whole house replacement water, once there is an MCL, then we cannot require replacement water unless that water is above, the domestic supply is above the MCL.
And who establishes the MCO?
The Department of Public Health. And we, as Lori said, heard that this number is going to be coming out shortly.
Do we have any authority over what level the Department of Public Health sets?
No, we don't have any authority over what that number is going to end up at.
Thank you. Ms. Kemper, could you address the issues about plume delineation that Mr. Banks raised?
I'm not sure which specific issues you mean in terms of plume delineation. I mean, I could probably address I guess maybe what you're asking is the specific concern Darren raised about the actionable items in the agreements that were made at the background during the background study meetings. So, my understanding, and Anne might be able to help me with this because she was at those, I think, at some of those meetings, but my understanding of the concern or the issue was that during the technical working group's meetings, there was a lot of discussion about will the USGS submit interim reports during the background study? Will the Water Board act on that information? Will there be some sort of structure to evaluating new information, you know, as the USGS sort of unveils information during the background study? And I think that there was a lot of discussion and agreements made about not having, you know, weekly decisions, or, you know, to try to have some structure around how decisions would get made, and that there would be input from the USGS about when data was sort of ready to be acted upon. That all being said, related to the USGS study, the Water Board staff, I know that Lisa Dernbach did let the community know that we have to act on data as it's presented to us in whatever format. So sometimes that information is information that residences provide, like the black water in wells or water quality data that someone else may have received, that we're often asked to evaluate data. And as much as we were trying to limit that as part of the USGS study, that was really in an attempt not to delay the completion of the study by getting caught up in a bunch of interim decisions before all of the information was gathered and a formal conclusion could be made. So in this particular situation that Mr. Banks brought up, it had to do with information that PG&E over the years has provided pieces of information where they've made a case that groundwater flow in certain areas basically would not result in any discharges from the compressor station reaching those areas. And we have frequently rejected some of those conclusions because we didn't feel that there was sufficient evidence. But in the last round of information that PG&E submitted, LISA evaluated that information related to groundwater gradients and agreed with PG&E's conclusion that certain areas were, there was a pretty high likelihood that they could not be impacted by discharges from the compressor station. So that's that. This sort of it sort of sounds like we have two, you know, we're sort of treating people differently, but really we are having to respond to information as it's presented. But there was a lot of conversation specifically related to the USGS study about not wanting to have to stop and evaluate data as it's coming in as part of the background study, because there's just going to be so much information, and trying to actually sort of schedule that sort of discussion. So I think that's where there was some confusion with the public about how we have to respond to data as it is presented to us. And if you want, I can point some of those areas out on a map if you want to go into this in a little more detail.
And if I could just follow up a little bit with Darren, some of your issues you raised. I know you were disappointed, as some of the community, about the letter that I issued in December delineating that the plume that Lori mentioned as well. But it was based on, we still have a job due to implement the plume delineation CAO, and we received a report with information. We had asked for additional monitoring wells to be installed, and that information came forward to us, along with analysis that Lisa Dernbach did on the flow in the area. And as Lori just indicated, we did the best we could with the information we had at hand to make a decision on where the plume is delineated at this time. And we did make a commitment to you and the community, as more information becomes known, that we will look at it as we continue on. So as Becky finds information over time, if we get new information, we can always consider it. And I also made a commitment to you to do a better job in terms of communicating to you and the community when you make decisions like this in the future.
Mr. Banks, I'm going to ask you to hold off. We've got more people who want to make comments, and you've had a lot of time to address the board already this evening. Mr. Booth, did you want to add something?
Yes, Dr. Horn. Richard Booth. I'm the hydrogeologist of the Hot Water Board, senior and trained geologist. If you would like some more detail to some of the questions that Mr. Banks raised, I'll be glad to give a little more background on how these decisions were made, if you think it's appropriate now.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I'd like to say that when we talked about, as you raised the issue of questions about plume delineation in the east, that we definitely used the best science for trying to determine where the plume that PG&E caused would have gone, would have wound up based on all the data that we have. And I want to emphasize that just because a chromium 6 value above 3.1 exists somewhere in the groundwater in that vicinity, that does not automatically mean that that level is a result of PG&E's release. We have to look at other factors of how the groundwater flow moves, and in factors like that, to determine whether any numbers that are above 3.1 could in fact be naturally occurring, because there is in fact values of chrome 6 above 3.1 that naturally occur in places. So the job of making that distinguishment, which will be helped quite a bit by the background study, as you've heard, nonetheless has to have be decided upon now, currently, as we draw the plume and we use the factors of groundwater flow and other scientific factors to make that determination of the plume delineation. And it's incorrect to assume that anything above 3.1 is a result of PG&E's plume. And then to the effect of comparable water quality, I'll hit on that real briefly. I want everyone to keep in mind that groundwater concentrations of chrome 6 vary over time for natural and sometimes artificial reasons, like a release of a plume. But the comparable water quality has to be looked at on the whole aquifer volume to determine whether the comparable water quality would be pertinent for everyone in the area, and an average value as determined by the background study that was done in 2007 is such number. That number is a should be considered as a comparable water quality because it's an average number over many, many areas and averaged over many volumes of monitoring wells. So I just want to make those points. Would have any entertaining questions that you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I have David Cheney.
Hello, David Cheney. I'm a resident of Hinckley, and I would like to thank the Water Board and everybody else in here for giving me the opportunity to speak. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for all of the hard work on everybody's part. I know that this is a long, drawn-out process of trying to come to some answers and conclusions to this problem. I'd also like to thank the CAC, Dr. Webster, PG&E, and everybody involved. I think everybody is working very hard on this. I came to speak tonight on behalf of the residents in Hinckley, like myself, that have chosen to stay in Hinckley. We don't have interest as far as lawsuits or anything like that going on. We moved to Hinckley and decided to stay there and live there. You don't see a lot of us at the meetings. A lot of us just don't want to go to the meetings and listen. There is a large community out there in Hinckley that still exists and will exist when all of this has gone away and will continue to live in Hinckley. What I would like everybody to take into account is when you're making these decisions, remember that there are people out there that you're probably not hearing from at this point in time, and they will inherit the product of your decisions. Dr. Webster pretty much covered what I had planned on talking about tonight by his change of path of making a little bit more personal contact with the residents of Hinckley. I'm ecstatic to hear that from him. He's a wealth of information. Getting a little bit of his time is not easy. And I'm really glad to see that he's going to be addressing the community more on a one-on-one basis. There's a lot of people out there that will not come to these meetings. They don't want to sit through it, and they're missing out on information. And the only place that they get their information is through the social networks and the stigma of what Hinckley has become and the toxic wasteland that it's referred to. I think maybe early on some of this could have benefited the entire community, and a little bit stronger education program, maybe on a daily basis, or having somebody available to talk to the public so that they can understand these things and have it explained one-on-one. I know for myself, the few hours that I was able to sit down with Dr. Webster, I got more out of that than the 100 slideshows. But I'd like to say thanks, and I just want everybody to remember that there is a community in Hinckley. There's a community that you guys aren't seeing. We're out there. We're not going anywhere. We've got our community center going, which PG&E has stepped in to support. I'd like to thank them for that. We've had community cleanups. We have another one coming. We're putting on health fairs. We've got things going, and we're not going anywhere. And one thing I am concerned about, my time will be twofold up here, is the heterotrophic bacteria and well fouling in the IRZ. To date, I still have no answer on exactly what the bacteria are, what the mycoplasma that is involved in it is, and what the potential dangers of that might be. So there's documents out there. The EPA have them. The health department has them. There's a lot of studies on it. I'm being treated right now myself for a mycoplasma infection in my blood. It did not come from the IRZ. But there's plenty of documents out there on it. I would encourage everyone involved to look into that. I'd sure like to know what's there and be able to say, you know what, there's no danger over there. So, again, I'd like to thank everybody involved here. Lori, thank you for always responding to my emails and phone calls. And Mr. Booth for his work with me. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming tonight. And it's hard for us to respond to people who don't come and share their thoughts with us. But we are very mindful that there's a community out there. And we keep that in mind. Thank you for coming. This heterotrophic bacteria question, is there some way we can address that at a future meeting? Or what would you suggest?
At this point, we had tried to reach out to the US EPA lab that Mr. Cheney brought to our attention that's been doing some of this research, and we haven't gotten any kind of response from them, unfortunately. So we now have asked Dr. Webster to help us out. So he's going to do some more investigation into the questions that Dave Cheney has raised, and Mr. Cheney's done quite a bit of his own research on this, so he's given us a number of helpful websites, and you know, a lot of really interesting research has been done, and so Dr. Webster's going to look into the ability to do like the bacteria speciation on the biological film that we're finding, you know, in some of these wells. It seems that it's a pretty specialized thing, you know, and that the US EPA, I don't know how many labs do it, but that's something we are going to continue to pursue. But we're at this point kind of relying on Dr. Webster to do some of that, do some more investigation. So depending upon what we learn, we can bring that back to the board and maybe put it in.
Yeah, please bring it back to the board when you have something reportable, and particularly, you know, to let us. To alert us if there are any risks associated with this.
Thank you. The last card I have is Leslie White.
Last one tonight, I promise. I just wanted to give you a brief. A brief statement on CDPH's. Ranking criteria on our integrated water plan. There's a webpage called mywaterplan.com, and it's Mojave Water Agency, and we ranked on CDPH's webpage. If you go there and put in pre-planning on their search engine, it'll pull up the state water project, and we ranked 19 on their list. And so we are funded. We just have to sit down with CDPH, and we're waiting on the call now to go over a funding agreement and basically a scope of work and to start the feasibility study for the water pipeline. So that was for that. And I just had one question about and a concern about these the water that's going to be taken out of the heifer dairy and used as dust control. My question was it was real vague in the order. My question is how many trucks are going to be used as dust control? And is this water going to be tested for uranium? And it also says in the order that the water is going to be used off-site also. So my concern is where is it going to be used at off-site, and how many trucks are going to be used off-site, and where is these locations going to be at? And that's one concern that is not addressed in those cleanup and abatement orders. Hinckley Partnership for Healthy Living we are donating our time to the Hinckley community to hand out bottled water at the fire hall, and we're servicing over 65 people with bottled water, and PG&E is supplying that water. And I just want to say thank you to PG&E for supplying that water. I do appreciate it, so does the community. So if you can pass on to Cheryl, we do appreciate the water that they're giving us. So, I guess that the next time I see you, I should have more of a presentation for you. I can sit down with the Mojave Water Agency and put one together, because we just don't have any more news yet. I talked to CDPH last week, and they're roughly about halfway down the the listing now. So roughly three more months. So I hate to wait any longer, but we just have to wait. So I appreciate it, and we'll see you guys next time.
Thank you very much. Anybody want to respond to his questions about the Heifer Ranch water being used for dust control? Who's the appropriate party?
I'd like to ask Kevin to maybe talk about where the water might be used. And I don't believe that we required uranium testing as part of that, as part of the current plan, but Kevin might be able to talk about that. And just in terms of the, I don't believe that we're finding much uranium in the shallow aquifer, so that is part of our rationale. But
could everybody hear her? I think everyone's going to have to speak up a little louder.
Yeah. Try that. The pumping that's designed to go on at the Heifer Ranch is essentially designed to be what we termed a long-term extraction test. There's technical uncertainty as to if more pumping is better there. There's a chance that too much pumping could make the problem worse. And so to try to get at that information, we were trying to come up with ways to move moderate amounts of water, more than what one could do in a one-day pump test, but less than one would do with an agricultural field. So we haven't been real specific on number of trucks and that sort of thing yet. We've talked about flow rates that are similar to what the Heifer Farm pumped there normally. So this is water that until very recently was used at the Heifer Farm, when the Heifer Farm was in operation. And so what we're trying to do is stress that aquifer to see if, in fact, we can change these concentrations of chrome, which again are about between seven and two, depending on exactly where one puts the well. So, our intent was that we pump this out, test it, prior to use. We then focused on chromium, and that if it was above 3.1, we would treat it prior to use. But at that point, it seemed essentially similar to any other well that was in Hinckley. If the chromium was below 3.1, it sort of fell into the same category as other nearby wells that folks would be free to use. We were envisioning using dust control at some of our construction sites. We have that need for water. Right now we go quite a distance down to Barstow to use public water up there. It's inefficient, but we've done that in the past, and we thought that by putting this treatment system in, we could take the chromium out of the equation and thereby have that water feel fit for use.
Do you have any idea when the the use of the water at Heifer Ranch, you'll have more clarity about what that'll be? Is it 3 months out?
Yeah, I think our picture was to do this for on the order of about 3 months. I apologize, I wasn't really prepared to talk on this tonight, but I think we were talking about a follow-up in Q2 because I know board staff's made it clear that they'd like to see ongoing action. We're trying to do that. That fits in a little bit with needing a place to put the water. So we're hoping to use this as sort of an interim step to both A, technically come up with a technically agreeable analysis that either says this is worthwhile to do in a bigger way, and then if so, that was what Lori had alluded to, that we'd pipe it over to the ag units. But it's sort of a two-step process that I would think in the 3 to 6 month range would be. We'll have to see what the data says.
Thank you. Any other questions? No other questions? Okay, with that, we'll finish up with item number 5. And what?
Apparently we have a hand.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Ian Webster again, IRP manager. There was some discussion about 20 minutes ago regarding the background study and the logic whereby Dr. Izbicki would funnel information into the process via an adaptive management process. I remember Mr. Dias asking maybe 6-7 months ago about the fact, why is this study going to take so long?
and this information that's collected on it, do we have to wait to the very end of the study before the information can be used? There's an enormous amount of debate took place in the technical working group regarding what Dr. Rizbicki has characterized as actionable, solid technical information and when it can be used. So Darren made some remarks tonight about Dr. Rizbicki's role in the process, but just to be crisp and clear about it, as I understand it, the IRP manager, at certain episodal points, not weeks, not months, but probably maybe even once a year or two times a year, Dr. Rizbicki will definitely come up with information that's important to the overall background establishment in Hinckley. And under an adaptive management process, it would be ludicrous to not look at that information and to try and decide how it could affect other parts of the project. So again, Dr. Rizbicki is very clear in the fact that he will develop these solid nuggets of information under relatively long time frames and then bring it into the technical working group for discussion, which then upon the water board can then act and hopefully PG&E would comply. So I want to be very clear about a well-defined mechanistic role for the use of the background study information. We don't have to wait to the end, but it's not going to be, as Lisa, as Laurie clearly pointed out, it's not going to be slice the salami every week information to change the direction of the project. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we are concluded with the status report, item number 5, which means we can go to our very last item, which is public forum on any issues having to do with PG&E or Hinckley that haven't already been addressed. So does anybody have any
no comment
cards on that? So with that, we will... what's the word again? It's not adjourn, is it? It is adjourn. Adjourn for the evening, and resume tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning. Thank you very much.